Good evening, everyone. It's nice to see you. Very nice to sit with you. Such a sweet, sweet group. If some of you may have been counting, you might know that for the last 18 weeks, that would be 4 months and 2 weeks, most of us have been sitting together under the series of how to meditate. So I want to say congratulations. It never ends, and I know you know that, but something else can come up. So congratulations. And even though there may be a closing to this series, if we don't sustain what we've learned, we'll forget it. That's the way of things. And we won't forget everything because the teachings remind us that we already know. We already know all of this wonderful things about the truth. We've just forgotten. So it's already in you. But you'll quickly forget about some things. So let's go to the next thing. How to build a practice. And in this process of how to build a practice, we'll have some homework. Being a principal, then, I'm teasing. I'm an ex-principal, but I'm no longer a principal. But the homework will be helpful too and supported. So to build a meditation practice, there's certain steps that we can take that will to help us establish a daily meditation practice. And these steps that I've come up with are typical guidelines for beginners, but they're only suggestions. There's others. And the sequence are not necessarily in stone, but we have found, Randy and I have found them most helpful in sustaining our own practice. And it reminds us we're all beginners, you know, with no end to the practice. And so we begin again. And in the Pali Canon, the Satipatthana Sutta is the resource or the source that we've used in teaching mindfulness meditation. And then we've got the Buddhist Abhidhamma, whole bunch of teachings from the Buddha. And so this mindfulness meditation and the teachings from the Buddha are what Randy and I teach. So let's look at the document, Steve, that I sent you, and I sent all of you. And again, this is just a guideline, but it helps. It helps us to have a sequence to look at. So, of course, the four foundations of mindfulness is the basis, is the basic. And we are working with being mindful of the body, whole body awareness, mindful of feelings, mindful of the mind, mindful of mind states, along with other things that can be learned under mind states. So, We practice mindfulness of the body, the feelings, the mind, and mind states. So the first is how to prepare for a practice. Well, there are, as you well know, very few things that we need in order to begin a meditation practice. In fact, all we need is ourself, of course. But there's a very important aspect to committing to this practice. And I sent you a quote from W.H. Murray, and I'll read some of it because this is the commitment I'm talking about. He says, until one is committed, there's hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans, that the moment one definitely commits oneself, the providence moves too. I have directly experienced that myself in my own practice because there is so much support system in my practice and some from places I cannot talk about. But it's like the whole universe sometimes is supporting the effort. So about commitment, that's a big one. About 6 months ago, Randy and I set a commitment, you know we're old, to exercise every morning for 30 minutes. And we knew what would happen because we know the nature of the mind. But we decided, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do it consistently. We're going to commit to it. But there's one thing that has helped us more than anything, and that was we said we're not going to listen to the mind. Now, again, the practice kicks in. And sometimes when we share with each other what the mind is saying to us, it's just a big, funny phenomena. We just laugh. Because the mind will come up with all kinds of excuses. But thank goodness we know the nature of the mind. Because without that, we would listen to the mind and not stay with a commitment, truly, that is in our best interest. So, every kind of excuse can arise, but just do it. Just do it. And we're learning how to live in the present moment where life can only be lived 100% of the time. So we don't want to miss any part of our lives. All right, Steve, you can take that down. Thank you, Stephen, for that. So we're learning to experience life instead of thinking about life. We're learning not to go to our heads all the time. But we're learning to have a healthy relationship. We're experiencing. And the whole body is where we experience it. So to begin, we just simply begin. And then when we decide to become a regular practitioner, there are some things that we want to remember that are useful. And setting a schedule, of course, is one of them. And the fruits of meditation are a manifold, and we really begin to see them and feel them when we practice regularly. You'll see that for yourself. But it's not to set up us for failure. So first and foremost, we're going to choose a schedule that's realistic for us. And then we're going to consider how long we'll practice, how long will we sit, and we can sit, to begin with, probably 10 minutes at the beginning, and longer when the practice has been established, because it's difficult, as we all know, to begin a habit of any kind. So we want to set ourselves up for success. So when we commit to this practice, we don't want to put ourselves in a position where we're going to feel defeated when we don't sit the day that we have committed to sit to. Because that's not part of it. That doesn't decide to create a little altar and display just reminders on our little altar that supports our practice. Maybe put a picture of the Buddha or someone you love dearly, someone you connect with, on the altar, or a candle, or maybe some incense. It's not necessary, but sometimes it sets the stage. It can be useful. Ram Dass used to tell us that he'd had a picture of Bob Dole on his altar, as a reminder, maybe, that we're all connected. Who knows? But we know he didn't support Bob Dole's politics, but somehow it felt supportive of his practice to invite Bob Dole to the sitting. And he would say, "Good morning, Maharaji. Good morning. Good morning to all his saints." Then he'd say, "Hello, Bob Dole." And so that is what happens. You know, whatever we find within ourselves that supports our effort to be in the present moment. And so joining a Sangha, which is exactly what you have done, there's a great deal of support. And I don't have to tell you, it's difficult to go alone. But remember the three jewels that the Buddha taught. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And these three jewels kind of remind us of where the path leads us, where we're going. The Buddha is a reminder that we all have Buddha nature, and that Buddha was just a human being. He modeled as a human being what we can open to. Everything is within. Love, hate, worry, peace, stillness, anger. It's all there. The long list of emotions that are important to our practice. They are a source of waking up to all of life. Doesn't sound right. But we begin to see the relief in that, because the wisdom comes with it. The wisdom will arise about the things that we have pushed away in our lives, that we can't acknowledge as human beings because it was too difficult. We didn't know what to do with the hate or the worry or the all the things within our lives that we've tried to stuff or run away from. But these are sources of waking up. So we establish that early in our practice. What causes our homemade suffering? Because most of our suffering, one teacher says 99%, comes from us. And the sad thing about that is it's optional. It's not necessary to live our lives. And so we begin to look at these homemade sufferings. And then the Dharma. The Buddha found that the truth of existence and how we can create our own suffering. He's precise, and the teachings trains us what to do, where to look. And right away, we add more happiness to our short life. And so it becomes compelling. So the truth within us will set us free. All of it. The good, the bad, and the ugly. And then the teachings, Dharma, teaches us that we are not our emotions, we are not our thoughts, we are not all the things that we have identified with for so long. It's shocking. But again, we keep holding that within our practice. And sure enough, sooner or later, we begin to see the truth of that. Rumi says, "Why would you stay in jail when the door is wide open?" And the third jewel is the Sangha, the most important of the three, the Buddha made very, very clear. And in my years of practice, I can say how we've relied, Randy and I, on our sanghas. Because it's difficult to go along. And throughout the years when we were retreat junkies, we had big sanghas. Because where we would meet up with a variety of teachers, there usually were the same people around the country. And so a big sangha, we began to hold a big sangha as we retreated with a whole number of people who turned out to be famous. We're not famous, but some of them are famous. So it's difficult to go alone. Joining a community of people who want to wake up. We know how that feels. We've been talking about it as a sangha. Even on Zoom, even on Zooming, finally, I don't know how long it took me, then I found the connection. Why? Because it's strong. The connection is strong. And it's a support system that steadies our own journey. And we feel safe with one another. We feel fully human. We feel that we can be the good, the bad, and the ugly with the wisdom from the group and within us. So there's an openness to truth. It's powerful. And the truth from wherever it comes. Is precious. So Sangha is a jewel. And I really preaching to the choir, I know. So let's go to the next thing. Posture. Now, posture, you know, for me at the beginning was, why so particular? But again, this is ancient teachings. So they're tried and true, which means that it works. So the posture of the head and neck and body being in a straight line is most conducive to being open to all the things that our quiet being is going to show us. It works. And I can remember when Jack would say, "Don't move." And I can remember say, "I can't do it." You know, I thought to myself, "I can't do it." And he would be encouraging and say, "Yeah, you're going to have an itch. You're going to have an itch. You're going to want to move, but it's part of the practice." Because I began to see that the movement was not necessary, but that I was in a habit of every little thing that came up in my body to attend to. It's unnecessary. And again, what the stillness does, and sustaining the stillness, is a way of great opening. We were in a retreat, a week-long retreat, and this particular teacher had us, well, we were sitting 45 minutes, which was what we always sat, 45 minutes, and then we'd walk 45 minutes all day long, day after day after day. But he lectured. We sat for 45 minutes. Then he would do his Dharma talk another 45 minutes. And then we'd do the walking for 45. Well, our tongues were wagging. I mean, it was a couple of days. And then after the retreat, when we talked, we were just saying, "Oh, it was killing me. It was killing me." But one friend who was with us said, and it was so true, she said, "I knew not to move." She said, "Because if I moved, it made it harder. Because the movement was not going to bring me any solace." Solace. Thank you, Randy. It was easier to be still. But she understood, she'd been practicing for a long time, but what she said was such deep wisdom, because it was true. The more I moved, the more I wanted to move. And again, it breaks our concentration. So why spend so much time concentrating if we're breaking it up every 2 or 3 minutes? It's not useful. But again, it's not to make you feel like, "Oh, you know, something's wrong with me. I can't be still for 30 minutes. Well, that's why it's called a practice. We just practice, and we begin to understand and experience directly why the stillness is so important. But again, our teachers would all say, if you're in deep pain, and we were, these were early on when Jack would say, "Don't move." Early on, you know, if you're in great pain, move. But if you move, move consciously, knowing that you're moving, that you're shifting. So the posture is no small thing. It is not. There's a big, important, supportive reason behind it. So whenever we're finding ourselves slumping, which I certainly do, we just remind ourselves to pull ourselves up into good posture. It's just good posture. So finding our seat, finding how to sit that is most conducive to what we're trying to do. And there's a real good reason behind everything that the Buddha teaches us. So, see where I am. So let's look at the body scan. That was the next. That was use good posture. So now we're going to body span. And many of you have heard this story, but it's the story of the teacher said very early on, go to the body. And where did I go? I went to the head. I had no idea that I had a whole body. Well, where, or I could be aware of the whole body. And yet, this is our curriculum. We take it everywhere we go. We don't go without it. And so I found myself not in touch with all of life, just from how I'm cut myself off from my body. So there's a big reason body scan, as Randy did tonight, is most helpful in establishing the practice of going to your body. Again, it's a practice, so we practice it. And sure enough, with time, we begin to live through the whole body. And the whole body has an intelligence that we need. And so, body awareness puts us the closest to the curriculum that we need to wake up. To wake up to truth. So the body scan, like Randy does, there's a big reason for it. And we want to see if we can begin to feel the sense of the whole body. Because we really want to begin living through the whole body. Okay, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to stop there at body scan. And next week, we're going to start with what to do next. After those things are established, then there's other things that we can remind ourselves within the teachings that will help us sustain and build a practice. Thank you.